Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence. Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again. And as always, I am your host, Mallory Ortberg, also known as Dear Prudence. With me in the studio today is someone very near and dear to my heart. But first, I need to talk to you about an issue that has been weighing on me for weeks. Every once in a while, a commercial will distress me so profoundly that I need to go on the radio to talk about it. In the age of Hulu and other streaming devices, I feel like we all just watch the same five commercials every day for months on end. It's a very different relationship than I used to have with commercials. Now I feel like I get to know them intimately. I feel like we're dating. I feel like I get a very intense relationship with two or three commercials for months on end. And then when they leave, I don't really know what to do with myself. And the ones that I've been thinking a lot about lately are those fucking Charmin ads for the toilet paper, and it's a family of bears that talk about nothing but taking a shit. I mean, this is a family that wherever they go, whether they're at work, applying for a job, visiting grandma, all they can think about is taking a shit. And it upsets me so much, mostly because someone just explained to me, I just got this. Because, like, why would you choose a family of self-aware bears to sell toilet paper? It's a reference to the expression, does a bear shit in the woods? And that made me so furious because that's such a stupid pun. And I'm so angry that I didn't get it immediately. And it just, there's nothing I can do about it now. And it's just upsetting on so many levels. Like, they're all nude. They're completely nude. And yet they're visibly worried about, like, not thoroughly wiping their asses. But it's like, clearly you would know. You're a nude bear. They also don't have visible anuses, which, again, is not like a sentence I ever imagined myself complaining about. And I feel uncomfortable doing this at the top of the show. Sorry, everyone, if you were listening to this on your lunch break. But like, if you are going to force me into a world where a family of nude bears is constantly talking about their fear of skid marks, and you often show me the animated bears' asses, and there is not an anus, like, How am I not supposed to think about this? Like, nothing about this world feels consistent. I feel worried about them and their health and safety, that this is the only topic of conversation. I feel uncomfortably, like, brought into the physical reality of these cartoon bears. And I just resent it on every level. I miss the, like, Quilted Northern ads where it was just the weird old ladies who would talk a lot about the, like, vicarious pleasure other people would get from using their toilet paper. I long for those genteel days. I'm upset by the Charmin Bears. I'm upset by the inconsistency of their physical reality. I've upset myself again talking about it, and I just want it to stop. I think it's a bad mascot, and if someone out there is listening, please change these ads or at least make it so that I don't have to watch them when I want to rewatch old episodes of Community. It's very difficult and painful for me. And on that note, and with the sincerest of apologies from me, I would like to welcome my guest, Zach Turner. Zach Turner is my brother-in-law, and I love him. He is also a sales manager who works in tech and lives in San Francisco with my sister, who he married. Zach, welcome to the show.
Mallory, thank you so much. I'm glad now that my introduction gets to be associated with the Charmin Bears.
I'm so sorry. I've just been thinking about that for weeks on end. It's been so distressing. And somehow finding out that it was related to the expression, does a bear shit in the woods, just pushed me over the edge in terms of absolute incoherent rage.
No, I totally understand that. As you say, though, time moves forward.
It does.
And advertisements for bathroom tissue is trying to move forward and changing.
Zach, I'm so glad that you're here. I love you so much.
I love you so much too, Mal. This is really fun. I think that you know this, but you're my favorite of all the family members, even Laura, your sister who I married.
I mean, you're my favorite too, and I didn't even marry you.
That's true. And now here we are giving advice.
And this is so fun. Listeners, I wish you knew how often Zach had asked to be on the show and that he came today with like a printout of all the questions and little notes he's written in the corner just like warms the cockles of my heart. So I've tried to select questions that I felt like would be particularly suited to your life experience, especially as like a manager and like a person with a lot of professional experience. Because I have spent the last couple of years now working on my couch. And so I've sort of lost the common touch of dealing with coworkers on a daily basis. And I sometimes forget the stark reality.
It can be the best part about working and the worst part about working.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad to have you on the show. I'd love to dive right into our questions. And would you be so good as to read the very first letter?
I would be thrilled to. Dear Prudence, I'm a recent college graduate who has moved home for a few months until I start my full-time job in the fall. While in college, I put on some pounds and am now slightly overweight. My mother was a yo-yo dieter for my entire life until this year she was able to successfully get down and stay at her goal weight. I'm very proud of her, but now I'm the subject of her scrutiny. I know that if I lost 20 pounds, I'd be much healthier and I'm trying to eat better and exercise more frequently. But she makes me feel horrible about myself because of my weight in just about every interaction we have. I'll catch her looking at me in apparent disgust, and she constantly comments on every food choice I make, even seemingly healthy ones. I ordered light salad dressing one time, and she told me I'd never lose the weight if I kept making choices like that. While I know that losing weight would make me healthier and look better, I am not ashamed with how I look, at least until I am around her and her constant reminders about my weight. I've gotten to the point where I resent her and try to keep our interactions to a minimum for the sake of my self-esteem. She is very sensitive to any sort of criticism, and when I've brought it up to her before, she says that she is only concerned about my health and happiness. Probably true, but she is going about it poorly. What do you suggest I do to get her to ease off of me and at least limit the weight loss suggestions to only every other conversation?
Whew. This one I read and I was like, oh, is she? Is your mother very sensitive to any sort of criticism? Because how rich is that?
She's sensitive to the criticism. She's the criticizer and
right.
She's sensitive to getting criticism about her criticism.
That was wild. This one, I don't know why this one leapt out to me so much, but it just seemed like such a great example of like how shame and constant criticism are actually not super effective weight loss tactics. And this is just like, man, if anybody is listening to this and like sees themselves in it, like please reconsider your choices. Like this is so clearly not helpful. This is not kind. This has nothing to do with health and happiness. Like this is just awful. Like this is just constant.
Yeah, no, it feels really messed up. And I did underline that piece about her being sensitive to criticism, where that shouldn't be the hurdle that prevents this writer from having the conversation with her mom. But I think there are a few different layers to this. And ultimately, I think some of what I sense is that her mom is the one that wants her to lose the weight. And she's pretty comfortable and okay with where she's at, although she you know, says like, oh, it could be better to lose some weight, but it's not necessarily like a big driver for her. So it's almost not that she wants to lose the weight to get her mom off the back. It's that she wants to have a hard conversation with her mom so that her mom, you know, cuts down on her criticism.
Yeah. I mean, this clearly has a lot to do with the mom's own issues, right? Like this is a person who has spent her whole life struggling with her own weight and her own self-acceptance and has very recently sort of achieved a weight loss goal. And now that she's done that, you know, but has clearly not resolved all the sort of anxiety and possible self-loathing and now needs a new target for that because she's not like at peace with herself, and the nearest person for that is her daughter. And I just want to throw this out there too. Like, you know, it's called the freshman 15 for a reason. We're not talking about like an issue where like your health is at risk. Like this is 20 pounds, which that's great if your goal is to lose it, but it's also not at all unusual. They call it the freshman 15 for a reason. Like this is not that there would be an amount of weight where this behavior would be okay, but I think especially because this is such a relatively, in the long run, small issue, it's even more clear to me that this is so much more about your mother than it is about you. And so please don't feel like, oh, I know she's kind of right, because she's kind of not. Like that's actually not there's not an amount of weight where this behavior would be okay. Mm-hmm. But yes, so I think you and I are both in agreement that this is a conversation that needs to happen. Do you think this is the sort of thing where you wait until your mom brings it up again? Or do you have a sort of like sit down, come to Jesus, mom, you got to knock this off? What do you think?
Yeah, I think she needs to have the conversation before her mom criticizes her again. I think if you do that in a criticism moment, it can lead to more escalated emotions. I actually resonate with this because I've been in a similar position with her with my own weight, with my own body and my own diets. And I've had folks that maybe have been more critical about food in my life or about my weight. And I think that a lot of it is going to have to be like, what does she really want and not what does her mom want? Like that's separate from kind of the harder conversation with her mom. But I also think like, hey, mom, this is my plan. This is what I want. This is what I feel comfortable with. And this is what I need from you. Maybe it's to stop bringing these things up, or maybe it's like, hey, you've controlled your own diet and your own weight. That doesn't mean that you get to control and impact my own weight.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I think let go of the fact that your mom's really sensitive to criticism, because that's just her problem to deal with. This is really appropriate for you to push back on. I'm also really glad that you're only home for another couple of months until you can start your own job in the fall. I think it will be good for you to not live with her. And I think also your strategy of minimizing interactions with her is a good one. If she can't keep her comments to herself about what you're eating, then I too would go spend time with other people. And that whole thing about how she says she's only concerned about your health and happiness, and you say that's probably true. I actually don't think that's true. I don't think that it improves anyone's health and happiness to hear things like, you know, if you keep getting light salad dressing, you're never going to be like a worthwhile person. You'll like that's she's saying objectively unkind things constantly, regardless of what you eat. Right. Like there's no choice you can make that is healthy enough for her to just not make a comment. So I think you can actually go ahead and call bullshit on that one. And I think that the thing you get to ask of your mom is just, I need you to stop making comments on the things that I eat. I like have my own health and well-being at the forefront of my mind. I'm making good choices for myself. I need you to trust that. When you make constant comments about what I eat, I feel scrutinized. I feel like objectified. I feel put down. I feel surveilled. It's irritating and it's unhelpful. And you need to stop. And if you can't, I'm not going to spend time eating with you. And you need to ask yourself why you are incapable of like passing comment on my food choices. And I think that's a really fair limit to draw. And if she can't do that, like, that's not hard. I eat out with people all the time, and I really limit my choices to what I say about their food other than, like, that looks good. Can I have a bite? That's kind of all you need to say. Like, you're doing great. There's nothing wrong with you. Your mom is being an asshole. She is not concerned about your health and well-being. She's trying to control and micromanage you, and she's being an asshole about it, and it sucks. But eat me. Come, call me. I will go out to eat with you. We will have something delicious and wholesome, and I will just praise you to the skies.
Food is good.
Food is good. Mm-hmm. Like, and you got to eat every day. Like, I can't imagine somebody every time I eat is just like, a jerk about it.
I'd be curious if this mom, her mom, when she was yo-yoing back and forth with her diets, like if she had somebody in her life that was criticizing and chipping away, or maybe that was even just a voice in her head that was kind of criticizing herself, that now she's, now that she's kind of sorted out her own weight stuff, that she's just kind of expelling that on her daughter.
Yeah. I think you're right. Like there is a degree to which probably a lot of this just comes from her own anxieties, but like she is a grown woman. She should go to a therapist or figure it out like in her food journal or something. This is not something to exercise on your kid. And yeah, so letter writer, like your question is just, what do you suggest I do to get her to ease off me? You tell her to stop. And if she doesn't stop, you limit the time that you're around her. Unfortunately, like she is not doing this for the sake of your well-being. She knows that. She knows that this is compulsive and nonstop, and you just need to tell her that you're not going to put up with it anymore. And that's going to be hard, especially if you already feel guilty about wanting to lose 20 pounds, which, again, I would just encourage you to, like, try to let go of some of that. Like, you're taking care of yourself. You're doing great. And your mom does not have the right to, like, yell at you about your salad dressing. Woof. All right. Well, good luck. Get that job. Get out of there. Let's go ahead and jump into the next one. Dear Prudence, I've been dating a wonderful man for the past 3 years now. We did long distance for a while, and now he is moving to another state with me, and we are moving in together. He's caring, faithful, honest, and makes me feel good every day. Everything is great, except for one thing. He's extremely introverted, and I am not. In our relationship with one another, that's never really been a problem. When we're together, he talks a lot, and he's really happy. I think that's because he's comfortable around me, and we love each other. However, I have groups of friends that I really care for, and it's been so difficult to get him into that part of my life because he's really uncomfortable with people he doesn't know. I'll bring him to a bar or to a dinner with me and my friends, and he'll really just sit there in silence. He doesn't make an effort to talk to them, and when people talk to him, his responses are brief, and it's hard to keep the conversation going. It's difficult because I feel like he's uncomfortable even though he doesn't say it, and at the same time, I feel uncomfortable because when I talk to my friends, I feel like I'm ignoring him. It's reaching a point where I'd rather go out with my friends without him, but I don't want to hurt his feelings saying that. I know he's had a hard time growing up because he had a speech impediment as a child and was homeschooled most of his life. So I know that he can have issues with social interactions and is much more introverted than I am. Now that we're a couple of months away from moving in together, I'm really worried this will negatively affect our relationship.
Man, introversion, extroversion, opposites attract. I can resonate with this one because I'm an introvert, Mallory.
You are. You have mentioned this once or twice.
And you know, when I think about introversion, it's really just where do you get your energy, right? It's do you get your energy from being with people or do you get your energy from being alone? And one of the things that she mentioned about kind of when it's just the two of them is that, you know, he's really happy and he talks a lot. And a lot of times introverts, like when they are with somebody that they really know well, that's when they really can open up. But yeah, this is a tricky one. And it's about to get real with them moving in together in a different state.
Yeah. And I'm a little... Maybe this is just something that naturally arises from spending a lot of time on the internet, but I feel like there's often this sort of magical thinking and this, like, I feel like people talk a lot about introversion and extroversion, and the kind of tone is, like, introverts are magical, lonely wanderers on the earth, and extroverts are boorish people that talk to you too much at parties. And if I identify myself as an introvert, what that means is I should never be asked to meet someone in the middle. I should always be left alone to, like, sit with a candle in a room, and I should never be asked to, like, make an effort. And I know that that's not what this guy is necessarily saying. I just feel like I do see that mindset fairly often, and I'm a little... I think that that's a little too pat. Mm-hmm. And so I always have that in mind when I hear someone say, well, they're an introvert, so therefore, like, they shouldn't have to do this part of human social interaction. I'm like,
I don't think that expression of your personality is an excuse for a lack of social effort or social skills. I think I am an introvert. I do get energy from being alone. But that often surprises people because I have a job where I manage people and I'm often in front of, you know, customers talking and interacting, and it takes energy out of me. But also I've worked on those skills. I agree. I think we kind of create a dichotomy that almost makes it too simple. And I think to your point of figuring out ways to kind of encourage him to not just sit in a room with a candle and, like, say, hey, I'm an introvert, this is how I'm going to be, is to figure out how can we scope this down and make it easier for him to get started.
Right.
It could be too much to go into a large group setting where it's overwhelming. But if you can figure out, like a couple ways that I think you could potentially scope it down is figure out like smaller group settings, maybe do something. I think in general, this might even be something that guys often do, but do a social thing that has an activity, mm-hmm. that has something for an introvert to do and not just sit and talk the whole time. But then also I think that there could be ways that she could encourage him on a person to get to know a little bit more, or ways that he could cultivate like a little bit better conversation. Like, hey, when people do ask you questions, you need to spend a little bit more time unpacking and articulating yourself a little bit more. I've heard it said that in conversations, there's three different layers. It's easiest in a shallow layer to talk about other people. Mm-hmm. Then the next layer is talking about events. And the third layer, the deeper layer, is talking about ideas. And I work with a bunch of software engineers, and oftentimes, you know, they might fit that traditional introvert mode, not be as polished socially. But encouraging them to think about, hey, have conversations with people about people, and then work your way towards events. And then once you can get really comfortable with people, being able to open up about ideas, that's like a really cool way to, I think, break down conversations.
Yeah. And I like that. I do like the idea of, no, you should not just like demand that he instantly become incredibly comfortable with talking to a ton of people at parties. Like, that's not the solution either. But I also worry a little bit that the letter writer is thinking, because my boyfriend is an introvert, he can't do these things or shouldn't ever try. It won't ever get better. And I don't think that that's the case. Like, the bit about growing up with a speech impediment and being homeschooled, it's a little unclear to me, like, is he extremely anxious about talking to people as a result of this? Like, is there some level of, like, do you believe that he has, like, anxiety or an issue or some sort of trauma around this? Or, like, that he's disclosed to you? Or do you just feel like, oh, maybe that's why? Because if it's, you know, if it's that he said, yeah, it makes it really hard for me to talk to people because of that, I'm always afraid that my speech impediment might return, or it reminds me of those anxious moments. Then that's really worth like addressing and accommodating and kind of checking through like, well, what makes it easier? Is it easier if we just have one person over at a time for dinner at the house and like you can get to know them more one-on-one like you did with me? Or are you just kind of filling in the blanks because you don't know, in which case maybe, you know, because some people did grow up with a speech impediment and were homeschooled but don't necessarily feel like that's going to influence their future social interaction. So that's something I think to talk about with him. And I think you also should just say in general, like, I love you. I love our connections. I know you're not necessarily going to love going to parties every weekend, maybe the way that I do, and that's okay. But it's really important to me to feel like you get to know some of my friends better. And that's a real goal of mine. I would love to feel like when we get together, you guys can kind of have conversations that don't require me, because I just want you to know the people that I love. And to sort of ask both, hey, do you think you'd be willing to make a little more of an effort when we do spend time together? And then also, what's easier for you? And to kind of work together on that. Because you do want to help him. You know, you don't want to make demands of him, but you also don't want to say, well, he's an introvert, so it'll just always be this way. And I think, Zach, I like your idea of kind of figuring out maybe there's an activity you guys can do. Because once he does get to know them, they will no longer be people he's uncomfortable around, right? And like, even if it just is one or two people, once he's got one or two sort of rapports established with them, it'll get easier.
Yeah.
And that will be good.
I think finding those ways to meet in the middle are going to be helpful.
Yes. Offer him help. Offer support. Find out what would be a more kind of low pressure environment that he could sort of feel more comfortable in. But also, like, if you guys are going out with friends and you want to talk to your friends and not kind of stay glued to his side the whole time, that's okay. You're not ignoring him. He is a grown man, and this is an area of life where he's going to need to develop and grow. And sometimes that might be a little uncomfortable, but like, he can handle that. He can handle be a little, you know, he's been an introvert his whole life. He can probably deal with, you know, some silences in the conversation. So please don't feel like unless you are sitting next to him being the cruise director of his conversation, you're being a bad girlfriend. If you want to go catch up with your friend across the room for like 20 minutes and then, you know, check in with him and wave and make sure he's doing all right, you can do that. And that does not mean you are abandoning him.
And that's too much stress and pressure to put on yourself to have to be that cruise director. I was just thinking like, it could be good to find ways to meet in the middle where you mentioned you find yourself rather going out with your friends without him. Maybe you should do that sometimes, or maybe you go out together and then he leaves early and you stay out with your friends. I don't think you need to feel guilty about that, but I think there's ways to find a medium ground there. Like, Mallory, you're taking Laura for a weekend this coming weekend. as an introvert, I'm thrilled thinking about the time I'll be able to have.
You love those weekends.
Exactly.
You just get to hang out.
And we have those maybe every other month.
Yeah.
And I think the last piece too, and this is just really important for the move, is if you guys are moving into a different state, it's going to be really important for him to develop other friendships and not have his entire relationship energy tied up in just yours.
Yeah. Like,
that is going to be something that he'll need to cultivate. And if he's got some friends with – or if you have some friends that can help that, all the better.
Yeah. No, and I think this is really good. You say he's, like, caring and honest, makes you feel good. It doesn't sound like he's just, like, uninterested in getting to know other people. So I think if you guys have these conversations and try to meet one another halfway, there's a really good chance that things will improve. And then you can also figure out, like, if you want to go out with your friends sometimes without him, that might be great for the both of you. That's not bad.
Indeed.
All right. I'm really excited for you to read this next one, because this is where we really start getting into some of the good work ones. And I have, yeah, this one is wild.
This one is interesting. All right. Let's go ahead and get on to the next one. Dear Prudence, when my boss left her position, she went a little crazy. While we had previously shared a good working relationship and a friendship, she became incensed that I told my organization that I would be taking over for her as an interim after she left. The news had already been announced in the office, and it wasn't a lie or jumping the gun to tell people. It was a big move for me, and again, it was already out. Regardless, she was angry and lashed out at me and about me all over the workplace. The way she acted out and some of the things I found out after she moved to her new job really left a sour taste in my mouth. This is a person who previously said that she thought of me as a daughter and her best friend and offered to officiate my wedding. I live in a very small town, and burning this bridge entirely is not an option. We will definitely have to work together. But I want nothing to do with her. I would like to uninvite her to my very small out-of-town wedding and end our friendship. But this is a person with a tenuous at best relationship with boundaries, and I do not want her to hurt my chances with this job permanently.
This feels like a plot line on the TV show My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And actually, I think it's just Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, not My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
And now it's Crazy Ex-Boss.
Yeah, no, 100%. The subject line of this, by the way, is not your damn daughter, which I really liked. Like, there's a real just like primal moment of childhood rebellion in here. Can you think of a way to uninvite someone to your wedding but maintain a good professional relationship? It's a tough needle to thread.
That is a very, very thin thread. I don't know if I have the magic answer. I number one, just want to say, like, good on you for raising your hand after she left and saying, hey, I can grow into this role. I can help kind of fill this gap when she leaves. So I just want to say, like, good on you for doing that. Her reaction to that is completely and utterly inappropriate. And, you know, you kind of explained and couched things like that you tried to kind of control the communication so that it didn't come out too early or too quickly, but it did because people needed to kind of move on. And I think there is something that's deeply personal, and I've felt this when I've left jobs, where you feel really invested in whoever's going to fill your spot and sometimes can have a lot of insecurity around that. So it's clear that there's a lot of insecurity. There's a lot of emotion that's tied up in her leaving and moving into another role or another company. And you taking that on in replacement of her. So I think that helps to just have some empathy where, of course, she's going to feel a little bit bummed out on being replaced. And it's unfortunate that it seems like the balance of that relationship, of that close kind of daughter-like, best friend-like relationship was based on a power of her being your boss rather right. than her leaving and then you guys more being equals in terms of how she sees you as a peer and a friend.
Yeah. So I guess I feel like – I'm wondering if, first of all, I'm wondering if, would she even want to come to your wedding? Like, is there a chance that she is so angry that she just won't attend? That might work out great. But then do you really want to take that chance, right? Like, if she has behaved so irrationally in the last couple of weeks or months, maybe she would do something outrageous, like show up at the wedding and want to fight about the job stuff. So my thought is, your wedding is small and it's out of town. I feel like you do have to uninvite her, because if there's even a 5% chance that she's going to show up and like spend the weekend in the same bed and breakfast as you and like attend your rehearsal dinner and get drunk and yell at you, like if there's even a chance that she will do those things, this is not like a 500 person wedding in your hometown where you can just kind of let her blend into the crowd or ask, like have someone ask her to leave. Like you do, I think, need to at least consider uninviting her. And my thought there is, like, you don't want to hurt your chances with the job permanently. I'm kind of wondering if your chances are already as bad as they can get. Like, she already clearly is, like, you know, speaking badly of you all over town because you inherited her job. Is there much of a working relationship to preserve? Like, could you keep her from continuing to say these things about you if you let her come to your wedding? Would that actually do any good? I'm not sure. Can you see a way where, like, they kind of paper over this and, like, can she just draw the line with the friendship but then be friendly and polite if she runs into her professionally? Like, is that possible?
It's hard. And I mean, you and I don't know how small this town is. And she mentioned she worked in a volunteer kind of nonprofit space. Mm-hmm. So it certainly probably is going to be a small circle of people in that industry in this area. You know, it's funny. I work in tech in San Francisco, and I still feel like it's a really small community where your reputation does precede you. So to think about that in a small town in a nonprofit space could make sense. I think honestly what she needs to do is she's kind of managing this tension of, frankly, if it was a bigger pond, she'd probably just cut it off and hope to never see her again.
Right.
But because she knows it's a small enough pond, she's going to see her. I think she just needs to have a really hard conversation and listen and ask and understand, like, hey, what is going on? Why are you feeling this way? How can we work through this for the future of us kind of being in a similar space? How can I help kind of take the baton from you and not take that baton and discount your work and what you've done, but kind of celebrate the work that you've done and how far you've taken this organization and then help carry it forward in a way that's unique and different,
right,
from you. I think it just needs to be a conversation and almost framing it as like the future of where we could go, just, and this is more on the professional side.
Right.
I think in terms of the wedding, after having that hard conversation, if it doesn't go well, you can be like, hey, it seems like this probably doesn't make sense for you to come to my wedding. Mm-hmm. Hope that there's some agreement there. And then you both kind of agree to uninvite this person.
Yep.
But I think if you have that hard conversation and then like talk about the wedding, if it's that she says, hey, I really do want to work at this and I do want to figure this out, maybe she can be vulnerable and open to changing.
Yeah.
And then maybe you do let her continue going to the wedding. But I do fear, I'm picturing Jim and Pam's wedding and Michael Scott, where he was just everywhere in that wedding weekend. Like it was all about him. And I could see this
that
former
happening.
Boss doing that. You don't want Michael Scott at your wedding.
Yeah. And I would say too, like hopefully the company that now employs you in that position knows that you are doing your best to work professionally. And if there's anyone you can sort of enlist to say like, hey, my goal is to maintain like a friendly professional relationship with former boss. Do you have any advice on how to help me with that? Like just to kind of let them know that this is going on in case like the things that she's saying do start to come back, like just to protect yourself. But I do think that that's a good idea, both for the sake of the fact that you're apparently going to have to continue working together in some capacity in the future, and also for the sake of the like long relationship you did share. And even if she reacts to it badly, like the goal is clearly not to preserve that closeness that you once had. Like that's pretty obviously gone. But for the sake of what you guys used to have to say, like, I you're clearly very deeply troubled by the fact that I've taken on this job. I'm not sure what I have done to upset you so greatly. I would love to be able to be at least like collegial with one another. Do you think we can do that? And if so, what do you want that to look like? And if she responds just totally banana pants, like, yeah, then I think you can say, okay, well, let's keep our contact to a minimum and I wish you the best and sort of respond to her outrageousness with calmness. And if she is able to sort of calm down, possibly apologize or at the very least sort of say, yeah, I was really upset, but I think I can rein it in the future, then you can sort of stay polite and distant with her. But man, yeah, I really hope she does not still want to come to your wedding.
Well, and there's some value for her too to save face if it's a small town and a small community for this former boss to actually like admit like, hey, I do want to work at this because we're still going to be working together. Like, I would say it's a big red flag for wherever she's going next.
Right. I'm just so confused too. Like, unless the letter writer took out like a skywriter the day the boss left to just be like, I'm the boss now. The previous administration sucked. I just can't understand that response, but
I mean, maybe there's something we're not seeing. Like maybe her boss was fired, right? Like when my boss left her position.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's a possibility, although she sure got another one very quickly, right?
Yeah.
It is possible she got pushed out and then, like, very quickly landed a backup job, which would certainly add a layer. But even then, like, even if you got fired, it's not your friend's fault that they became... There's kind of nothing the letter writer could have done short of, like, orchestrating her boss's firing and then stealing her job and, like, talking shit about her behind her back that would have justified.
Oh, man. I mean, take the higher ground. And then based on her reaction, you can kind of make the call on the wedding. And I think if it's the wrong reaction, you totally have justification for that.
I think so, too. Yeah. And I'm just sorry. It's really sad when somebody that says that they think of you as family sort of reveals that they apparently feel like being family means they can treat you very, very badly and over, like, very little justification. All right. So good luck with that one. I hope your wedding is attended only by people who wish you well. Let's jump into the next one.
This one's fun. Dear Prudence, my department recently hired a very nice employee whose personal habits are, to say the least, less than fastidious. They have been observed picking their nose, coughing directly onto our communal keyboards, walking around in bare feet, eating at their desk, and so forth. This person tends not to take care of themselves, and as a result is unwell more often than not. The upshot of both of these things is that almost every single member of our department has been off sick at some point since this new coworker started, almost to the exact week. The new person gets sick, and we all follow. This has been going on for a few months now. We've tried general department memos about keeping ourselves healthy over the winter, planting a variety of things like hand sanitizer and tissues all over the office, and requesting that everyone sanitize their desk when they leave the office at the end of the week. Nothing has stuck with this employee. As their direct supervisor, I certainly don't want to make them feel bad about themselves since it's none of my business how they handle their own health. But it's directly affecting our lives now, as well as one coworker who had to miss a flight because of strep throat. Is there anything kind but firm we can do for this employee to get us all healthy again? Sincerely, stuck with the sniffles.
I love the sentence. As their direct supervisor, it's none of my business how they handle their own health, after explaining to us that this person's, like, very bad personal hygiene has directly affected everyone else's ability to get work done.
I think that answered it right there with that sentence.
Yeah, like, right? Zach, like, you're a manager.
No, I've actually had to have a conversation like this with somebody that reports to me. And, I mean, I think as the boss, you have to be constantly asking yourself, what hard conversation am I not having that I should be having? And I think this is a hard conversation that, you know, Mr. or Miss stuck with the sniffles, you just need to have. You just need to bite the bullet and do that. I've gotten a really good framework for giving feedback or having conversations like this recently, and that's to make sure that you're caring personally while also challenging directly when you give feedback. So you need to make sure that you're caring well and also being direct and clear with them. And so I think you just really need to say, like, hey, this is impacting everybody else in the office. You've already unpacked some of the evidence of what this person needs to do. It almost seems you guys are just beating around the bush and trying to hope that that person just picks up on the cues. It actually reminds me of my first job. There was a guy in my office who was very similar to this person. I had to use his keyboard one time. And when I typed on the keyboard, there was just, like, smudges from grease. And as I typed, like, crumbs, like, popped up out of the keyboard.
No,
he didn't floss. Like, his coffee breath was terrible. But nobody had the courage to tell him that.
Right.
And I wish that as a 23-year-old in my first job that I had had some of that courage. I wasn't his direct manager.
I was going to say, I wish his manager had had the courage because it was not your job.
Exactly.
But, yeah, that seems really fair. Like, this is very clearly – these are not personal issues. Like, as this guy's boss, yeah, you have to be the one who says – again, as you say, compassionately, don't be like, you're disgusting, you disgust me, I hate you. But say, don't pick your nose at your desk. Please don't cough, cover your mouth when you cough. Wear shoes at the office. The eating at the desk thing feels less relevant, but, like, if they're not disinfecting their desk at the end of the week, you can say that. Like, as you know, we've made this announcement, you're not doing that, you need to start. These are all very clear action items, as people like to say in offices. They fall within your direct purview as his supervisor. And you don't even have to, I mean, in your mind, you can say, like, I think that's why such and such people have gotten strep throat. But you just can stick with, like, that's not like, for the health of the office, we need to do all of these things and you're not doing them. And I need you to start doing them now. And if you don't, I will let you know. I'm going to hold you accountable. So if I see you like coughing on your keyboard, I'm going to tell you to cover your mouth. And if I see you walk into my office and you don't have shoes on, I'm going to say, go put your shoes on right now. Like, I think that's frankly about as kind as you need to be. This is not like, again, this is a situation that calls for like basic garden variety kindness, but you don't have to like be overly gentle. This is really unacceptable office behavior. And if he showed up at an interview, like if he was interviewing for a job and he didn't have shoes on and he picked his nose and he coughed on the like his interviewer's hand, they would not hire him.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is one of those things where I think you might care too much in giving feedback. So you need to be more direct.
Right. And this isn't as personal as like, oh, my friend sometimes has bad breath and I'm afraid to tell them. Because, of course, that's a totally different situation. This is like bad behavior.
Yeah.
That you just get to fix.
It sounds like an interesting department. Like, is this a lab or something? Like, it seems very kind of communal and collaborative with sharing keyboards and equipment.
I mean, if it is a lab, it's even more important to, like, sanitize your desk. Like, if you guys are developing new medicines that I might be taking at some point, please, you know, don't cough directly onto the keyboard.
We have an open floor plan so everybody can see each other. Nobody has a closed-door desk. And I have a very strict policy with my team that when people are sick, they're not to be in the office.
Yeah.
Because it does, like in our environment, it can lead to everybody getting sick. So you might even revisit kind of your out-of-office policies
yeah.
as well.
But be direct. No more communal emails. No more signs saying sanitize your hands. Call them in for a meeting. Say, I've noticed this issue. You're a great employee. I really like you. And this needs to change. And then, you know, stay on top of it until it gets better.
Should we get to the last question?
Yes, please.
All right. I'll read it.
Thank you.
Dear Prudence, I am a recent college graduate, and throughout college, I worked the same part-time job in retail. After graduation, I became a full-time employee and was promoted from cashier to lower management. I love my job. The people I work with are great. I get full benefits, including health insurance, paid vacation, and a 401k. I'm also able to save about 40% of my take-home pay. The problem is that my family keeps asking me when I'm going to get a, quote, real job that utilizes my degree more, and they're openly derisive about my work. I'm tired of defending my job to them. I'm fully self-sufficient, so I feel their opinions are unwarranted. I've tried to talk to them before about how hurtful it is that they invalidate my work, but they usually just laugh at me. How can I get them to take me seriously and stop mocking the job I've chosen?
Has anyone ever mocked the job you've chosen?
I think I've had to explain. Yeah, my 90-year-old grandfather still doesn't understand or believe that the cloud is a technology phenomenon that's going to work. So he's the person who always – he's the person who criticizes like, hey, when are you going to work for a real company, a real job? And I work for like a publicly traded, like decent-sized tech company. But
he's like, what about Boeing? That's a real company.
So I have had that, not to this degree. And, you know, I was thinking about this where, like, what is the definition of a real job? I mean, for a recent graduate to have full benefits, health care, paid vacation, 401k, and also to be pocketing a ton of money, like – to me, I'd argue that's a real job own definition.
What kind of family? How comfortable must they be that that's the kind of job that everyone's like, psh, that's made up? Like, you guys, you must come from a long line of very fortunate, well-off people. What? Assholes.
Yeah. I mean, I get that there's like an obsessive comparison disorder that like recent grads and even parents can have, like wanting their kids to have like a really high power, high paying job. Or like on a career track like that. But also like you also mentioned how much you like the people that you work with and you're getting all of those other benefits. Like, yeah, it could be hard if you're just eking out a living or if you didn't really like the people that you worked with. But you've got everything that you need for a real job to be able to be like a fulfilled, contributing citizen of
I mean, you got a job after graduation. Like as somebody who graduated college in 2009, that is a miracle. I mean, I have a job now, obviously. I'm doing fine. But like most of the people I knew after college were desperately looking for work. And like a lot of people had to like really struggle to try to make ends meet because there were no full-time jobs for recent graduates. And like that your family is being so dismissive of this is just man, what a bummer.
Yeah.
I mean, I could understand if they wanted to have a conversation about, hey, you just got this degree. Do you ever think that it will be, like, applicable to your career? How do you think about that? But that's not the conversation they're trying to have with you, right? They're just being jerks. To me, the solution to this is I think you can absolutely kind of draw a line when it comes to mocking the job you've chosen, but to sort of let go of the hope of them taking you seriously. Like, who cares? They're clearly being unreasonable. And I think if you stop trying to kind of chase that gold ring of getting your parents to approve of your choice, you will feel a lot better. And I think you're already partway there, right? Like, you already know that you're self-sufficient. You know that their input doesn't really affect your choices. So I think just having kind of a stock response of, I love my work, I get great benefits, and I'm saving 40% of my income. If you can think of another job that will do that, you know, I'd be interested. No, that kind of opens you up to them, like, trying to come up with other jobs. Yeah, just say, like, I love my job. I'm not sure why you feel like this is not enough, but, you know, drop it. Like, that was maybe the worst off-the-cuff, like, response I've ever tried to compose for someone else, by the way. It just fell apart by the end.
It worked. And speaking of old millennial and young millennial, like, there's always talk about how hard it can be for kind of this generation to get those first jobs. Like, I think you can contrast that and be like, hey, like, mom and dad, like, it's hard for people that have recently graduated. Look at all that I do have. Like,
yeah.
And even ask, like, what is your definition of a real job? I think I freaking have that. And I really enjoy this. And, like, if you can have that conversation about why and what is a real job to you, and then explain to them how this actually fits into what you want and kind of what matters to you career-wise and that it's fulfilling, like, good on you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just unfortunate. And I think it's good on you, too, for getting promoted up through that. Like, that's a great sign.
Yeah. Yeah, it says something about, like, the fact that the people who saw you working with them through college were like, we want more of this. That's fabulous. So, yeah, I think that kind of combination of, like, if they invalidate it, bummer for them. Like, too bad that they don't get how great your job is. And to kind of just say, like, to just sort of cheerfully, don't even, like, defend it. Just be like, I love my job, which is not really an argument. It's just a statement of your feelings. Because if you get kind of lost in the weeds of, but I get this from my job and I get that from my job. Like, if they've just decided it's a bad job no matter what, they will always have something to come back at you with. So I don't think it sounds like you've already kind of explained what you love about the job. So don't get caught up in that too much. I think just focus on, I love my job. I get great benefits. I'm really happy. Let's change the subject. And to just really, like, make that be your kind of theme song. And, you know, if they really don't drop it, you can always just say, like, hey, I'm going to head out. And, like, let's talk sometime when you want to talk about something else.
Yeah, I would say having that conversation is going to be really worth it. I'd also say that, like, what you're learning in this retail job is going to be super applicable to anything else that you might want to do. You're learning a lot of people skills. You're dealing with a lot of you're growing in your career. You're learning new things. Like, those are all really good things that can be applicable in other things. And if that is something longer term that you want to do, like, maybe you can say, like, hey, I really enjoy this now. I have a longer term vision for something around here. That can maybe be a helpful way for them to bridge that gap in this time period where you're working in this retail job. And I'm going to take a different tact, Mallory.
Mm-hmm. Do it.
But I do believe that Wayne Gretzky is right. He says, skate where the puck is going.
Oh, my God.
And I do just worry about the retail industry. And I know that there's been talk about e-commerce and all that good stuff for a long time. But there is a lot of hard data around the decline of retail jobs over this last couple of years. So something to just be mindful of.
Always have a backup strategy.
If this industry never exists.
Yeah. Wow. Well,
but I don't think that's going to
happen. I can't believe Wayne Gretzky is, like, talking shit about the retail employees of the world. That's no, really cruel,
but
Wayne.
The spirit is, you got to go where where the industry is. You got to go where the jobs, where the future is.
Sure. I mean, I don't know what the specific company they're working at is like. And all industries are a little shaky anyways. That's probably not true, but it's how I feel. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would just say, too, there's something to be said for, and this is less like long-term career advice, which I'm sure that that's genuinely helpful. When we were little, Zach, sometimes we would ask Dad, like, a series of questions. And at a certain point, it became less about, like, we want to know the answer and more just, like, can we stump Dad? Can we prove that he doesn't actually know why the sky is blue or whatever? And we would just get to a point where he would kind of say, you know what, it would be a world record, which was sort of like his loving way of saying, like, it is impossible to answer all of your questions, and I am lovingly choosing to disengage. And I think there's something to be said for that strategy. At a certain point, if they just keep asking you, when are you going to get a real job, to just go with, probably never. Which is not the same thing as, like, slinging their shit right back at them or getting really shirty with them. It's just this sort of, like, loving disengagement of just, like, probably never. I'll probably always be a bum. To just sort of, like, opt out. Like, if they're just going to keep asking you the same question, just give them a boring kind of uninterested answer. Like, oh, never. There's not a lot they can do with that. And then if they continue to kind of, like, sniff around you and say, but this and this and this, you can just sort of cheerfully say, you're probably right. I'll probably be miserable. Is there more pizza? And, like, just, like, you've got it all, right? Like, you've got the good job. You've got the 401k. You're socking away 40% of your savings every month. And someday when they all need to go into a home, you can just laugh and laugh and laugh and say, I'm spending this money on buying a diamond yacht for myself. And I hope you go to one of those homes where there's no windows.
Yeah. 401k is awesome.
Yeah. Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Zaki, thank you again so very much. I'm so glad that you came. And, please come back on the show sometime.
This has been so much fun. I'd be thrilled.
And please help me put more pressure on Johnny now that he is the only outstanding family member
I was going
to
say, is Johnny the person who's walking around his office with bare feet and eating at his desk? Because that could be him.
Sounds 100% like something Johnny would do. Although the like coughing directly on the keyboard, I think Johnny would not do. But yeah, you know what? I would like to take this moment to officially call out John C. Ortberg III, my little brother, who is a physicist. Not Stanford. What's that other school?
UC Santa Cruz.
That's the one. Thank you. I don't know what school he goes to.
Go Banana Slugs.
Go Banana Slugs. I want to call him out. He is an idler, a trifler, and a non-producer. He refuses to help family members in times of need. He does not listen to the show. He will never hear this. Johnny, come on the show. And afterwards, I will buy you lunch and drive you back to Santa Cruz, unless you already have your car with you. I love you very much, and I just want to hang out with you. Zach, thanks.
Thanks so much, Mal.
Thanks. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, you can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute tops.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.